The wake for the deceased man began at 4 o'clock on a Thursday, which struck Wren as appropriate. Thursday was the day the living made their peace with the week's accumulations before the weekend arrived to offer another. He had been 73, a retired cooper whose hands had shaped oak staves for 40 years and whose death came quietly in his sleep. There was nothing spectacular about the circumstances, nothing that would warrant more than the standard arrangement. A medium-grade casket, lilies from the garden center, and the usual procession through streets lined with people who had known him by name, if not by anything deeper. Wren stood behind the preparation table and arranged her hands in front of her like a novice at prayer. The embalming room smelled of formaldehyde, and something beneath it, the sweet, cloying odor of decay, held at bay but not conquered. Through the small window in the door, she could see the parlor beyond, where the mourners sat in the front row with their daughters kneeling beside them, and a scattering of men from the church stood near the back wall in groups that shifted whenever someone new entered. The room was warm. Too warm. She had lit the coal stove early, as was proper, and the heat pressed against the windows like a living thing. She washed her hands again. This was the third time since 4:30. The soap was harsh, yellow, and left her skin raw at the knuckles. She dried them on the linen towel and watched the water drip from her fingertips onto the tile. Each drop made a small sound, a precise punctuation. She liked the sound. It was honest. "Your mother used to do that," Silas said from the doorway. He leaned against the frame with his arms crossed, wearing his best suit, the charcoal one with the silver buttons, and his expression was somewhere between amusement and concern. She'd wash her hands until they bled. Your father would bring her tea, and she'd drink it with bandaged fingers. Wren didn't respond. She picked up the tray with the prepared implements, forceps, sponges, the small silver bowl, and carried it toward the parlor. The hallway felt narrower than she remembered, the wallpaper darker, the gas lamps casting long shadows that pooled in the corners like spilled ink. In the parlor, the mourners turned as she entered. Thomas Mercer's body lay in the casket, which was a good one, mahogany with brass fittings, the finest they could afford from the modest estate. He looked peaceful enough. The preparator had done his work well, though Wren noted the slight stiffness in the jaw, the way the left eye sat a fraction lower than the right. These were imperfections only she would notice. To everyone else, he was simply at rest. Mrs. Mercer rose when Wren approached. She was a small woman with thinning hair pinned severely back, and she wore black in a way that suggested duty rather than devotion. Her hands were clasped so tightly at her waist that her knuckles showed through the fabric. "Wren," she said, her voice was thin, strained, "thank you for coming so quickly." Wren set the tray down on the side table and opened the ledger to the page marked with a sprig of dried lavender. She ran her finger along the column of figures, checking the cost of the mahogany casket against what Mrs. Mercer had agreed to pay. "The lilies are from the garden center," she said, "and the postmaster has already been informed of the burial time. Is there anything you'd like changed before we proceed?" Mrs. Mercer's mouth moved, as if she wanted to say something else, but she nodded instead and stepped aside. Wren took her place beside the casket and waited. The first visitor approached within the hour, a man Wren recognized as the postmaster, Mr. Abbott, who stood before the casket with his hat in his hands and his eyes fixed on Thomas's face with an intensity that surprised her. He remained there for nearly 10 minutes, saying nothing, merely staring. When he finally turned away, his eyes were red, but his face was composed, almost proud, as though he had performed some private ceremony. "Did you know him well?" Wren asked when he returned to the group near the back. Mr. Abbott started as if he'd been caught doing something improper. "Thomas? Oh yes, very well, 20 years at the post office, side by side. He was a man of routine, that one, never missed a day, not once." His voice cracked on the last word and he cleared his throat. "A man of routine." He joined the others near the stove, where they were discussing the weather and the state of the roads, and Wren watched them with a detachment that frightened her. She stood at the edge of the room, occasionally nodding at visitors, occasionally offering a murmured word of condolence, but mostly she observed. She counted the faces. She noted the way each person performed their grief differently. Mrs. Mercer's daughter, Clara, wept openly. She sat beside the casket with her face buried in her hands, her shoulders shaking, her cries sharp and unmodulated. Every time someone passed the casket, She lifted her head, touched Thomas's hand, whispered something that might have been a name or a prayer, and then lowered her face again. It was the kind of grief that demanded witness, that required an audience. Wren found herself watching Clara as much as she watched the mourner studying the performance of sorrow, the way one might study a play, looking for the seams in the costume. The Reverend Pike arrived at 5:30, bringing with him the smell of rain and pipe tobacco. He was a broad man with a florid face and a voice that filled rooms without effort. He moved among the mourners like a general inspecting his troops, offering pats on the shoulder, murmured assurances, and the occasional firm handshake. He spoke to Mrs. Mercer first, placing both hands on her upper arms and speaking in a low, resonant tone that Wren could not quite hear but could feel vibrating in the floorboards. "We shall commit him to the ground," the Reverend said, loud enough for Wren to catch, "and the earth shall receive him with honor as he deserved." Mrs. Mercer nodded. She did not cry. Her face was a mask of composed suffering, and Wren wondered if she had saved her tears for the burial, if she was rationing them the way one might ration bread during a lean winter. By 6 o'clock, the parlor was full. The gas lamps hissed. The coal stove radiated heat that made the air thick and difficult to breathe. Someone had brought a plate of biscuits and jam, which sat untouched on the side table, and the lilies in their brass vase began to shed their petals, scattering pale pink circles across the carpet. Wren stood near the window and watched the street outside. The sky had darkened to a deep gray, and the first drops of rain began to fall against the corrugated iron roof of the station visible down the hill. She pressed her forehead against the cool glass and listened to the sounds of the wake, the murmur of voices, the occasional sob, the creak of floorboards beneath shifting feet. It was a symphony of loss, conducted by the house itself, and she was merely a musician in the orchestra, playing her part without feeling the music. Silas appeared beside her. He had loosened his tie and rolled up his sleeves, revealing forearms that had grown softer with age. He smelled of cigar smoke and the lavender water he applied to his collar. "You're quiet tonight," he said. He reached into his coat pocket and drew out a small silver thimble, placing it on the windowsill beside her elbow. It belonged to Mrs. Mercer's mother. Wren recognized it from previous wakes. Silas had retrieved it himself from the drawer where the family kept such things, the ones meant for the daughter to wear when she needed to touch the dead. "I'm observing." "Observing is fine." He tipped his head toward the parlor, where Mrs. Mercer was now dabbing her eyes with a handkerchief that had clearly been prepared for this purpose. "Just make sure you're visible when it matters." She picked up the thimble. It was warm from his pocket. "I'm observing." "Observing is fine. Just don't forget to participate." She looked at him. "Participate how?" "In the grief, Wren, it's expected." She considered this. Grief was expected of her not just from the mourners, but from the town, from Silas, from the memory of her father. She was the daughter, the heir, the one who had returned. She was supposed to grieve in a particular way, measured but visible, restrained but genuine. She was supposed to cry at the appropriate moments and offer comfort to others while concealing her own pain. It was a script she had never been given but was expected to perform flawlessly. "I am grieving," she said. Silas studied her face. His green eyes were sharp, assessing. "Are you?" The question hung in the air between them, heavy and unresolved. Outside, a cart passed on the wet road, its wheels splashing through puddles, and the sound faded into the rain. "I am," she repeated, and meant it in a way that surprised her. She was grieving, yes, but not for Thomas Mercer. She was grieving for something she couldn't name, something that lived in the space between her ribs and refused to be articulated. It was a grief without an object, a mourning for a loss she hadn't yet experienced. Silas didn't press the matter. He placed a hand on her shoulder, brief, firm, paternal, and moved back into the parlor to greet another visitor. The night deepened. Visitors came and went in a steady stream. Each one performed their relationship to the dead with varying degrees of conviction. The men from the church spoke of Thomas's faith and his service. The women from the sewing circle spoke of his kindness and his generosity. The men from the market spoke of his business acumen and his reliability. None of them spoke of the things that might have been less flattering. His stubbornness, his temper, the way he could be cruel when drunk, the arguments he had with his wife in the evenings that she thought were muffled well enough for the neighbors not to hear. Wren noticed all of this. She watched Mr. Abbott's gaze cling to Mrs. Mercer's daughter with an interest that had nothing to do with mourning. Two men from the church conversed in hushed tones about the mill and the river, speaking of a deal that had gone bad rather than Thomas. Her eyes settled on the empty chair near the back, where someone had clearly been expected but would not be coming. And she noticed her own numbness, sitting inside her like a stone, cold and smooth and impossibly heavy. It was not absence. It was present something there, solid and immovable, anchoring her to the floor while the world around her floated in a sea of performed sorrow. She wondered if this was what her father had felt when he stood behind the preparation table for the first time. She wondered if the stone had been there all along, waiting for her to arrive. At 8 o'clock, the last visitor departed, a young man Wren didn't recognize, who stood before the casket for only a moment, nodded once with a curt jerk of his chin, and left without speaking to anyone. The parlor emptied slowly, the mourners filing out into the rain, their black coats darkening with moisture, their faces turned upward to let the water wash over them as though cleansing. Mrs. Mercer was the last to leave. She stood before the casket for a long time, longer than any other visitor, and when she finally turned to Wren, her eyes were dry and clear. "He would have liked you," she said. "Your father, he was a good man." Wren nodded. "He was." "And you'll carry on." "Yes." Mrs. Mercer's mouth twitched, almost a smile, almost a wince. "Good. Oakhaven needs good men, good women." She paused. "Rest well, Thomas." She left, the door closed behind her with a soft click. Wren stood alone in the parlor. The casket was still open. The lilies had shed more petals. The gas lamps flickered, their flames thinning as the pressure dropped. She walked to the casket and looked down at Thomas Mercer's face. He looked exactly as she had prepared him, pale, still, empty. A vessel. A container for the memory of a man who had shaped oak staves and worked at the post office and died in his sleep. She reached out and closed the lid. The brass fittings caught the lamplight and threw it back in small, sharp flashes. The sound of the latch engaging was final, definitive. Thomas Mercer was now sealed inside his casket, removed from the world of the living, committed to whatever came next. Wren remained still in the dimness, the silence pressing against her eardrums until it hummed, a heavy, suffocating pressure that seemed to seep into the marrow of her bones and rewrite the history she had inherited, leaving her alone with the terrifying realization that the ledger was not merely a record of debts, but a map of sins she could no longer ignore.